I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is kosher meat. In particular, kosher meat in Germany, which is the subject of a new book by John M. Efron entitled All Consuming, Germans, Jews, and the Meaning of Meats. And in this book, John profiles the history of meat in Germany as it relates to Jewish culture over a 700-year period and looks at the contested culture around meat as expressions of engagement with food and Jewish culture are reflected in literature, sculpture, visual arts, as well as in legal codes and commercial enterprises across Germany. It's a really interesting book that goes from the Middle Ages to today. Very fascinating, a subject that I was not particularly familiar with before looking at the book and talking to John. So really enjoyed the discussion. Want to get right into this one. So here is my chat with John M. Efron. All right. And John M. Efron joins me now. John, how are you today?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
Very excited to have you here to talk about All Consuming, Germans, Jews, and the Meaning of Meat. Now, before we get into really the teeth of the book, curious about your background and how you approach this topic, how you come to this topic, because obviously the book, as I said in the intro, 700-year history, it's really temporally very long. So how do you decide to write something that is covering such a large period and such an interesting topic within Germany?
I speak in the acknowledgments. It's partially autobiographical, the acknowledgments. I dedicate the book to my mother and to her kitchen. My mother is an extraordinary cook, and I was privileged to grow up with this, you know, making haute patisserie and various other, cooking with French techniques and things like that. So it was always just a huge part of my life, but it wasn't anything that I'd written on. It was just something I had lived. And I had decided some years ago to write a book on sort of like a history of German Jewry through the prism of the five human senses. And I thought I would start with smell. Because I knew that there were sources for that, and there were medieval sources for that, and so I began in that vein, and I finished that, and then the problems began to mount. That is to say, you know, what do you do with sight? Is it what German Jews saw? Is it what, you know, how German Jews were seen? And the same with hearing. And so it was a very nice idea, but I don't think it was ultimately very doable. But the chapter to do with smell had to do with a unique anti-Semitic motif that only appears in Germany, and it's a thing called the Judensau, which is the Jewish pig, and sort of beginning in the 13th century on churches, on carved into choir stalls, misericords, and various other aspects of church architecture, we begin to see the depiction of Jews begins with Jews with pigs, just holding, say, a piglet. Then it progresses to Jews being depicted as suckling at the teats of pigs. Now, pretty much every sort of medieval trope about Jews, whether it's ritual murder charges or host desecration or well poisoning, sort of European wide. Only this aspect appears in Germany. We have no idea why. And so these are things carved in stone, literally carved in stone. With the advent of print, then these things go viral and they become ever more extreme. Mm-hmm. And Jews are depicted in ways that are the most extreme depictions of Jews in the history of sort of anti-Semitic iconography. That is sort of not just suckling at the teats of pigs, but drinking their urine and eating their feces. And you can do that in a way with, you know, with print culture that you can't do in stone, things like that. So what was significant about that for me is that Jews are not depicted contravening the dietary laws by eating the pig. They're never seen eating the pig. but it's waste.
Mm. Right.
That's somewhat swimming. So that just got me, that set me to thinking about Jews and what they eat and food and how that may be seen through German eyes.
Right.
And it was that got me. And so you have this animal whose meat is eaten from snout to tail by everybody. The one thing that is never eaten, and you probably never even join these two words together, and that is pig's milk.
Yeah.
That is just not consumed.
Yep.
And that's what they're first shown consuming. So it's inhuman to begin with. It's outside the norms of, you know, normative food consumption, let's say.
Yeah. And just so we're clear too, because the book follows such a wide temporal framework, when you're talking about Germany, because the understanding of what Germany is changes over the 700 years that you're writing about, how are you defining Germany? Are we talking Germanic people, or like, obviously we get into the nation state towards the end of the book as we know it today, but just how are you defining and understanding Germany?
Look, more technically correct, it would be sort of, you know, German speaking lands,
right.
German lands. But that's just too cumbersome for the title.
Yeah. It needs to be more pithy, right?
And so, I mean, it's the area that sort of most closely corresponds to today's Germany. But I do deal in one portion of the book with Switzerland, and Austria is also makes a mention as well. He's mentioned as well in a few instances, but largely it's in Germany.
So you mentioned the depictions of Jews, as you say, drinking the milk of the pig, eating feces of the pig. So when you're seeing those early depictions, what is the cultural social context of the time? Like where do you think that depiction is coming from? What is the motivation for it? And what is just generally the place of Jews within a Germanic society when you're starting to see these images?
So they have something to do with depictions of the seven deadly sins. And so in a society that's largely illiterate, obviously iconography is the reading matter that can be put before an illiterate public, okay? What is unique about this statue called the Judensau, the Jewish sow or the Jewish pig, is that all of those other ones are sort of generalized depictions of the various vices, greed, lust, gluttony, that kind of thing. But this is the only one where a specific identifiable group of people are associated with these vices. And most accurately, I guess, from that perspective, depicted as, you know, consorting with the most gluttonous, the filthiest, most unclean animal. And so that's where they come from. But then they begin to take on a life of their own with the fact that all of the characters in the Judensau, whether it's in the early depictions in stone or wood carvings, or certainly later on, once with print culture, they're all identifiably Jewish and are said to be so.
And how do we know that? Like you mentioned sort of the images of it, but when you say they're clearly identifiably Jewish and depicted as Jewish, what are some of the ways in which they are being depicted and that makes it clear that they are Jewish?
Oh, sure. Well, the men have beards, which is sort of a typical feature. And with the later ones, certainly in print culture, they are very often depicted as wearing a badge, a Jewish badge, right, as some star or badge like right. that, as had been commanded by the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215. Jews were to wear specific kinds of hats, and so in Germany, some of the depictions are Jews with sort of very pointed hats, which are typical of that country, and a badge on the left cloak on the left hand side of their outer garment or cloak. So we know they're Jews. And very often in the print ones, attending to this scene of depravity, because it's always a group of Jews, right? There's the devil. And the devil in one particular infamous one, but a very well-known one, is seen holding up the tail of the pig in order that a Jew can consume its waste. And that devil also has a Jewish badge on his garment. So right. The Jew is devil, the devil is Jew. So there's no mistaking what's going on.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Now, when you talk about depictions like that, clearly they would come across to me as a layperson to this as being anti-Semitic and clearly anti-Semitic. But as we were talking before, you mentioned it's the relationship and the depiction or the relationship between Jews and meat in Germany hasn't always been a story of anti-Semitism. Right. So, you know, where do we see that evolution? Where do you start to see depictions that aren't as explicitly anti-Semitic as these ones that you're talking about, some of the origins of where the book comes from?
Well, the depictions themselves tend to be anti-Semitic over time, like from the Middle Ages to the modern period when they're depicted. And I speak about those in the book. But in contrast to theological positions, so the church admonished, and not here, not just in Germany, but the church admonished Christians for consuming the meat of Jews. They ate meat from Jews. And why is that? If I can explain how that comes to be. So the rear end of a quadruped is not kosher, even though it's like a cow is kosher. Jews eat steak, brisket, they eat meat, right? But the rear end, where it has a sciatic nerve, the sciatic nerve cannot be consumed.
Okay.
To remove the sciatic nerve is extremely difficult and has always been recognized as being an act of butchery that is complicated, that takes a lot of time. Not everyone is skilled enough to do it. So that's why sort of like a rump steak is not kosher. Okay.
Okay.
But you can't throw away a third of a cow.
Right. Yeah.
So from time immemorial, right through to today, that rear portion of a cow or a sheep or a goat is sold to non-Jewish customers. And those non-Jewish customers are very happy to eat this perfectly good meat. Now, the church always admonished Christians for we should not be eating, or you, they would always say, you should not be eating the meat that the Jews reject. That's sort of an ultimate insult. All right, so that's a theological position. But then there's the realities of the marketplace and economics. And of course, this was to the advantage of the customer because the Jews couldn't throw it away, but the market set the price somewhat lower.
Yeah.
So interestingly, the dietary laws, which are, you know, a code of laws that are designed to distinguish and separate Jews from non-Jews. There's no, I mean, all the cultures have things to separate them. Even the admonishment of the church not to feast with Jews, not to eat with Jews, which was repeated at one church council after another, was designed to keep the parties separate. So it's not just a one-way street, it's a totally two-way street. So they, in the separation that is codified in the dietary laws, it's those very dietary laws that actually bring Christians and Jews together in this act of economic codependency.
Right.
So that's rather interesting. So that's a positive story, because meat markets traditionally are very competitive places. Butchery is very competitive because you have one stall in a marketplace after another selling exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's highly competitive. And I would say that and this is a positive part of the story, in contrast to the social position of Jews in the Middle Ages, which was wretched at best and risky and violent, you have this story that in Germany, the evidence that I came away with was that the laws governing Jewish butchery and the laws governing the place of Jews in the meat markets was ultimately quite fair and was designed to ensure that both Christian butchers and Jewish butchers could earn a living, not at the expense of each other, but by cooperating with each other. So the medieval story came as quite as a surprise to me, I mean, because of one's association, because this is at the same time that you have the Judenzau. Right. This is at the same time that you have all sorts of accusations to do with the blood libel and ritual murder charges, host desecration, well poisoning during the Black Death. But then you have the reality of the marketplace.
Right. Yeah. It's again one of those things where the answer to all your questions is money, and you know, like where you can come together and do it. And is this part of, because the book gets into and talks about the idea of Jewish people educating non-Jews about their practices. Is this part of it? Is this sort of this on the ground person to person engagement at the meat market? Is that part of what you're talking about? This sort of that social interaction that can help account for or overcome in some circumstances some of the anti-Semitism and those depictions that they're seeing elsewhere?
Yeah, no, that's that aspect of sort of education is a modern phenomenon and begins in the 19th century, and it goes equally well for Jews as well. I mean, Jews also, who had drifted away from, you know, Jewish practice, not necessarily drifted away from being Jewish, but Jewish practice, were also educated by knowledgeable Jews on what the meaning of the dietary laws are and what their place is and why they should be retained. And so it's about education for both Christians and Jews, but that's a much later. That's a much later story.
Okay, so getting back to some of the earlier stuff, then we'll get into the 19th, 20th century in a little bit. As we talk about the consumption of meat, you mentioned that this is specific to Germany, what you're seeing in these depictions. How is it specific to Germany? And like, what are some of the theories that you have, some of the ideas about why you're seeing such a difference in these Germanic cultures compared to other parts of Europe or around the world?
That's the $64,000. Yeah. I don't have a really good answer. I mean, there is no, and I've read a lot of the scholarship on this, there's no really compelling explanation as to why these depictions almost exclusively, there's one or two in other places, but almost exclusively appear in German lands, so here, Austria and Germany. So I can't definitively tell you why, but there is something. There was a folklorist at UC Berkeley named Alan Dundas, who passed away, who made the case, and he based it on sort of Freudian scholarship. So he was a very fine scholar, but I think he has a book called Life is Like a Chicken Coop Ladder. It's about the place, the place of scatology in German culture, and there is something that's particularly scatological about German culture, even in their swear language. Right, when they swear, it's usually not the way that Anglophones swear, but it usually involves the word Scheiße to as in shit. to describe this, that, or the other. But there's a lot of evidence that he brings to bear. So there is a particular focus. There is a particular focus on that within the culture. Why that is, I can't tell you. No, I just don't know, and I wouldn't really hazard a guess. But the images are extreme, and we don't really know why they appear there, or to put it differently, why they don't appear in other places. Right. Because the sentiments about Jews in the Middle Ages are universal. They're not specific to Germany in any way, shape, or form. In fact, the blood libel first appears in England in 1144. It's an English invention. Hmm. So the ritual murder, you know, in France. I mean, so there's nothing specific to Germany about this. This particular image is.
Right. And, yeah, that's the thing that's so interesting and curious, but also engaging about it, is that you do have this very specific to Germany imagery, but the sentiment behind it is not specific to Germany. So it's this very interesting expression of a sentiment that exists really all over, but they're doing it in a very specific way.
Right. And not just that, but it is with the animal that is taboo par excellence for Jews.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
One could have theoretically done the same thing with a horse or something like that.
Right.
But no, it's a pig.
Yeah.
And so that has a certain resonance and meaning at some point. Right.
Now, another thing that's specific to Germany that you mentioned before we started to record is Reform Judaism with its origins in Germany and the desire there. Or the discussion there surrounding dietary laws as it relates to Reform Judaism. So how does that fit into the story here as you're talking about the consumption of meat, the meaning of meat within Jewish culture, and then you have this Reform movement that's really going alongside this imagery and the other things that we've already talked about? How does this all play together?
Okay, so let me just go back a little bit before the 19th century, because in the discussions in the 18th century, there began to be discussions about whether the Jews can be emancipated and be made citizens. They had no civil rights before emancipation. And the emancipation debates were on for a long time, and they were vociferous, with some Germans arguing for the necessity to grant Jews civil rights and emancipate them, and others saying they can't be emancipated. And among the questions is, can Jews be made Europeans in general? Can they be made Germans? Can they? Is there anything in their culture that prevents them from becoming German? Do their customs perhaps inhibit the possibility of them attaining citizenship and fitting in? And meat and the dietary laws, I think, represent perhaps the most visible sign of Jewish distinctiveness from Christian society. That is to say, you know, belief in Jesus is an article of faith. You can't see it. But this is a tangible, touchable, and tasteable object of differentiation.
Right.
And there were those people who said that Jews could not be granted citizenship because of their meat. Now, this is also sui generis, because there were, you know, emancipation debates in France at the time of the French Revolution. Can the Jews be made Frenchmen? Can they be given citizenship? And there were those who said yes, and there were those who said no. But even among those who said no, there was no mention of their meat. Only in Germany is the subject of meat as a criterion for citizenship raised as an issue. So there were Jews, there were Germans who said the Jews should be emancipated. So that's the positive side of things. But when those who were opposed to it, there were some of those who were opposed to it who raised the issue of meat and the inability of Jews to create fellowship at table with non-Jews, which is for them was a sine qua non of being a compatriot. And if you couldn't sit down. And another accusation was that, you know, the ultimate duty of a citizen when called upon, is to defend the country. And one of the opponents of Jewish emancipation said they would not be able to join the army, sort of the Prussian army, for example, because they won't eat the rations.
Right.
They can't eat the rations. And so they cannot be soldiers alongside us.
Right. And that's interesting because it gets into this question of community. And so much of food is about community. It's not so much when you get together, it's not always what you're eating. It's the fact that you are together, you are eating. Hopefully it's good, whatever you're eating, if you're at a big group dinner or something. So that does lead me to the question about questions of community. As we're talking here, like once we get into 18th, 19th century, is it that simple of like, because we can't sit together, because we're not eating together, that creates that separation and the division that already existed and the discrimination that existed can't be overcome because you have such a visible sign of separation. And, you know, the idea of coming together, eating, there's a communal aspect to it. The fact that that is not necessarily possible based on what could be being served, is it that simple, but does that serve to perpetuate the existing distinctions to the point where these debates ultimately get, or questions around emancipation are just so intertwined with these broader community questions?
Look, the people who used meat as an excuse for not granting citizenship have a list of complaints as long as your arm. Right. They're not meat related. Right. But for me, it was interesting that this was one of the factors that they identified. And food is essential. It's obvious. We can't exist without it. We do it 2-3 times a day. And so it was very meaningful to me, and that's why the book has the meaning of meat in the title. One of its meanings was the social separation and the inability for those who wanted to see it, Jews as unable to fit in, that the dietary laws caused this chasm to exist within society between Jews and non-Jews. So anyway, what I was getting at is, there are already debates within the context of discussing, can the Jews be made citizens? Can they get civil rights? Should they be emancipated in the 18th century? The reform movement begins, sort of the first reform temple is opened in 1818. And then over the course of the next couple of decades into the 1830s and into the 1840s, as Reform Judaism was working itself out, and they had a number of conferences, you know, rabbinical conferences, et cetera, et cetera, the debates came to the same issue. You know, what about the dietary laws? Do they keep us from becoming German? Jews are now asking this question, do they keep us from, you know, fellowship at table with non-Jews? And there are some who said yes, that, you know, they're past their use-by date. These are ancient laws. They're biblically grounded. This is the 19th century. We don't need this. Reform Judaism focused, rather than on orthopraxy, focuses on ethics, you know, prophetic scripture. So ethics was more important than traditional practice. So Jews themselves began to ask these questions, and that follows on because the Jews are, to get further on, the Jews are not eventually emancipated in Germany until 1871. It's very late.
Right. Yeah.
So there was lots of opposition to it.
Well, it's interesting too that the discussions also turn internal. Like, do our dietary rules and the laws that we have, does it inhibit our social standing? Does it inhibit our place within the broader culture, right? That those questions are being asked, again, speaks to, as you say, the meaning of consumption, the meaning of meat in this case, but how important it is. This goes beyond just what you consume when you sit down to have a meal, that there's a greater significance to that. And for the community, the Jewish community themselves, for individuals who are advocating for change, how do they, and how do you as a scholar kind of understand the questioning of the practice, and it has the traditions from the Old Testament and traditionally throughout to this point, as you're talking the 19th century, how do they balance the tradition, the biblical side of the practice towards the practical reality that, oh, this could be something that might benefit us socially, economically, culturally, whatever it is. Like, it just seems like a very interesting line to be looking at, and a tight wire act almost that some of these folks have to be performing as they're going through and having these conversations.
What's so compelling about this particular story is the fact that food is so elemental. And you know, there are cases in the book where I have sort of testimony of a Jew eating non-kosher meat for the first time, you know, pork sausage, and it's a moment that this person considered worth writing about at some length. It's a big deal. I mean, I know this from people who have eaten non-kosher meat for the very first time. There is no, by the way, there is no hierarchy of something that's kosher or not. Pork is no more unkosher than sort of a rump steak. There's just no such thing. Or cheese or wine. There is, you know, non-kosher versions of this, but there's something different about meat.
Right.
And in Jewish culture, there's also something different about pork. Not in Jewish law. Jewish law makes no distinction. Non-kosher is non-kosher. There are no degrees of kosher. But this is a psychological moment when you put a piece of meat in your mouth. You know, meat is highly charged for almost for everybody. In one way or another, it's not like any other food. It's in a completely different order of food. And so there were Jews who were worried that as time went on, say, by, you know, the debates begin in the 18th century, but by, you know, 1810, 1820, 1830, 1840, they're still not emancipated. So various discussions were had as to what can be done within Jewish culture to modify Jewish culture and make it, modernize it, and make it compatible with modern German culture. And there were those Jews who thought that change, that one locus of change would be the synagogue, to transform the synagogue service. And that's what Reform Judaism tried to do. They sort of modeled, among other things, the service on a Protestant, contemporary Protestant worship service. And so in doing that, that occasioned another discussion of meat within the Jewish community, nothing to do with, well, Germans are in the background and the prize, eyes on the prize is emancipation. But one of the things that they focused on was the liturgy. Now, there's a prayer in the liturgy that is said on Saturdays, on the Sabbath, and on Jewish holidays, and also when the new moon is out, right? And that's an additional prayer called Musaf, in lieu of the additional portion that was taken to the temple to sacrifice on those days. But after the destruction of the temple in the year 70 by the Romans, there's no more animal sacrifice in Judaism. It becomes rabbinic Judaism, right? But the prayer is still there. So this was very troubling for Reformed Jews. Like, what are we going to do? Because the prayer asks for the restoration of the Jews to the land of Israel, the rebuilding of the temple, and the reinstitution of animal sacrifice. This is not a good thing to be asking for in the 19th century.
Sure.
According to some Jews, right? So this in turn occasioned a debate of how we maintain the prayer, change the wording, because of this very meat-centered, ancient, and what would now be considered barbaric practice of animal sacrifice. And what's interesting in Germany, of course, is that, you know, one can appreciate sort of modern Reformed Jews recoiling at the idea of, you know, praying for the return of animal sacrifice. But the other thing that happened coterminous with the advent of Reformed Judaism in Germany is the advent of modern Orthodox Judaism. That's also a German invention. And they were as dedicated to German culture and German bourgeois culture as the Reform Jews. Hmm. And they too, but they too were, they were in a bind because they refused to countenance any change in the wording of the liturgy, but they didn't want the return of animal sacrifice either.
Right.
So they had to just interpret the meaning of animal sacrifice differently. So all streams, again, there's no other place in Europe where you have the advent of Reformed Judaism or the advent of modern Orthodox Judaism. These are German inventions. So this is getting back to your earlier question about the specificity of Germany. So from the internal Jewish side, there are very, there are many aspects of the book that are Germany specific. But it's interesting that Reform and Neo-Orthodox Judaism, that, you know, there's so much friction between them and they just don't see Judaism similarly, except on this one issue.
Right.
Maybe in a few other issues, but one of the issues in which they sort of share a modern bourgeois sensibility is, well, we don't want animal sacrifice to come back. And the Reform have no qualms about changing the wording of the liturgy, but the Orthodox can't, but they then come up with a different interpretation.
And that speaks to how personal some of these topics are. And certainly when you're talking about the ways in which people build and maintain relationships with God, it is done in a lot of cases through this communal aspect. There's these groups that you're part of, but it's also individual at some level. So the way that you are practicing your religious beliefs speaks to who you are. And it there's a lot of identity questions here at play. And obviously the book goes into a lot of this. It's a really broad book. So we'll sort of wrap up. I'll get you out of here with this. The question then of legacy of this. I mean, when you're writing about such a long period and about such an important topic that goes beyond, I think, the significance of this book, yes, it's about Jews in Germany, but there's a lot of things that can be applied elsewhere in the world to other religions as well. A lot of these broader questions that you're talking about. So what do you want readers to get out of the book, and what is your expectation not your expectation, what should readers' expectations maybe be when they're coming to this book?
Well, I will say, and I'm quite proud of this. This is not a story that's been told before.
Right.
This is a very different story. So one would come away with learning something that has not been really given any consideration by other historians before. So that's important. I begin in the introduction by talking about taboos surrounding meat in other cultures. There are other cultures that have very specific rules about whether to eat meat, and if they do eat meat, what order certain parts of the meat are eaten in, who gets to eat those prized parts. It's usually the males in traditional societies. Mm-hmm. So meat occupies a place of universal significance. All cultures, and those cultures that don't eat meat. At the end of the day, vegetarianism is not about vegetables. Vegetarianism is about meat,
right?
And the avoidance thereof. So, meat structures one's diet, even if one doesn't even consume it. You're eating in reaction to meat, or you're eating because you like meat, or because your culture says you can eat this meat. That you can eat meat. In Judaism, you can eat meat. It's not a culture that rejects meat, but you can only eat certain kinds of meats, certain types of meats, and depending on the way they're being killed. So, and it's very and the laws are extremely in their broad outline. They're simple, but in reality they're very complex, and there are sort of volumes and volumes of written about the dietary laws. So, I want to introduce this aspect of Jewish culture to people that may not know about it. And I want them to understand, I think, that this story can in some ways presage things that come later. So to stick with Germany for the time being, in the 19th century, there was a concerted campaign in Germany, and this is a mixed story of good and bad, or bad and good. There's a concerted campaign to get rid of kosher slaughter, which is simply, there's no stunning of the animal. That's forbidden in Jewish law. And the animal's throat is slit very, very speedily. rapidly, and there's a massive what's called an exogenous flow, right? The blood flows in a torrent, and the animal is rendered unconscious within seconds. This was regarded as cruel and barbaric, and there was an unholy alliance in the late 19th century of animal rights societies in Germany and anti-Semitic political parties. And what's interesting about Germany is that, and I detail in the book the parliamentary debates. And what's interesting, of course, is that when you have the parliamentary records, you know, they'll have the times that a discussion starts and when it ends. And there are discussions that go on in the Reichstag, in the parliament, for 4 and 5 hours just about this issue.
Wow.
That shows you something. That doesn't exist anywhere else. But the point that I'm getting towards is that the lobbying, the intense and relentless lobbying, particularly in the 1880s and 1890s, to get rid of kosher animal slaughter, always failed. And it always failed because of, there weren't Jews in the parliament, but Jewish lobbying efforts and their allies in the parliament, liberals, and very interestingly, the Catholic Centre Party.
Hmm.
The Catholics came to the party to protect Jews on the basis of freedom of religion, which is enshrined in the German constitution at both state levels and also at the national level. And so you have this story of these, and these, when I say these are anti-Semitic political parties, I don't mean that they're parties who happen to be, have an anti-Semite in them, or they brand themselves. Their entire raison d'etre is to be an anti-Semitic political party to fight the Jews at every turn, who they blame for all the ills of society. So they are bona fide anti-Semites, and proudly so. So in a country where this exists, it's also a country where allies rally around the idea of religious freedom, and they always fail to win the day and to outlaw kosher slaughter. So that's an interesting story as well. Now, the point that I'm getting at here is that the same forces of political parties, of ill will, and animal rights societies have banded together again today with the focus on halal slaughter.
Hmm.
But it's a redux of the Jewish story from the 19th century, but it's happening today in Germany.
The way history is, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes, right? And we're certainly seeing it.
That's what we're seeing. That's what we're seeing. So there's a, you know, it's an instructive lesson to learn the prehistory. And one would only hope that the same adherence to, you know, constitutional freedom of religions obtains in this latter instance.
Yeah, very well said. Very good example. And yeah, another reason to pick up a copy of the book. Again, in 45 minutes here, really I can only scratch the surface of everything that's in this book. So certainly would recommend it. Again, it's all-consuming, Germans, Jews, and the Meaning of Meat. John, if you want to get a copy of the book, keep up with what you got going on, what's the best way for them to do that?
It's Stanford University Press, and can either be bought through their website or, of course, Amazon. And local bookstores are carrying the book, as far as I know. It comes out on Tuesday, but I've been told that there are local bookstores if you prefer to buy them, those establishments.
Yeah, we love our local bookstores. And if you ask for it, they'll always get it for you. That's what's great about local bookstores.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, and again, we will put a link to the Stanford University Press page down in the show notes below. So be sure to check it out. Again, All Consuming, Germans, Jews, and the Meaning of Meat. John M. Efron, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
So there you have it. My chat with John M. Efron. Again, the book is All Consuming, Germans, Jews, and the Meaning of Meat. And I thank John for his time. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which today comes from The Washington Post, an article by James McCauley from October 9, 2018, entitled Why Halal Meat Generates So Much Controversy in Europe. And this is following up on what John mentioned at the end of our discussion, the bans on halal meat production in Europe. And in the article, James McCauley goes through and gets into the history of this, why political parties support these bans and how they come up periodically. There's a cyclical nature to it. It's a really a fascinating article that gives a little more context to what John was talking about at the end and puts the book into a greater context as well. So while John is focused on Germany and the specifics of Germany, what is unique about the German culture as it relates to kosher meat, James McCauley in this article just gives a broader sense of the situation now. So John has a wonderful profile of kosher meat in Germany, and then this article can give a little bit broader context to what's going on today in Europe. So today's historical headline of the week from James McCauley, October 9, 2018, why halal meat generates so much controversy in Europe. And with that, I'll say thanks so much for listening, everybody. If you haven't yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcast, like, rate, comment, all that stuff. Helps other people find the show, keeps us growing, and of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of the great written material is there on the website, plus under the podcast tab, all of our past episodes are available for you. I'm on the road this week, which is why this sounds a little bit different, but we'll be back in the studio next week when we join you again for more What's Old Is News.